Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 7 of NML Crossing, where today we are uncovering one of the many blind spots I have in my comics knowledge and library. It's funny, I think of myself as being fairly knowledgeable in this little niche hobby of ours, but I don't know, I'm finding out more and more what I don't know and what I have no real frame of reference or experience with. Today, we're covering a book right out of that playbook. But before we get into it, I wanted to talk about... it's weird, I've never read this book before, but it takes me back to... Just looking at it takes me back to a different time in this... in this industry that we all, you know, love or tolerate or used to love or enter whatever you got here. And the reason it takes me back is the cover. Now, it's, you know, it's just a cover. It's a cover that shows a scene that we're going to be reading about in the book here, which back in the, you know, mid-late 90s, turn of the century, was, you know, pretty commonplace. It was pretty commonplace up until... you know, the mid-2000s, I'd say. But it's not the content of the cover, but it's the style of the cover. And I don't know if this will make sense to anyone but me, or if maybe I'm being too precious with my, I don't know, art. I can't call it an art critique, but my art appreciation, maybe. The cover, it's by the same artist that did the interiors, Jim Ballant or Ballant, or I don't know how you say his name. I'm going to say Ballant. But it's in like a totally different style. You know, the cover looks more polished and it pops more than the sequential art inside, which, like I said, it takes me back to when artists would put a little bit extra into their cover work because they knew that that's the cover and that's like a big deal and people are going to see it and people might decide whether or not to buy the thing based on, I mean, we're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but it's definitely something that we do, right? So it kind of gives me, you know, the cliche warm fuzzies to see that an artist puts a little bit more effort into their cover because back then covers mattered. You know, Catwoman number 56 back in 1998 wasn't getting 35 variant covers, you know, 34 of which are lazy pinups or blank. You know, this was actually a time where, I don't know, the cover had to kind of speak for the comic. It's kind of this weird frontline advocate for the comic or any given comic where it could make or break the book. And I don't know, it really... you know, it takes me back to when that sort of thing was a thing. And I miss it. Not to sound like the, you know, dude yelling at a cloud or whatever, but I definitely miss this sort of a feel. And, you know, speaking of this this run of Catwoman here, it's funny. The other day, as I was trying to fill in the remaining holes in my NML Crossing to-do list, I went to a store that, it's actually a store I hadn't gone to in about a year because, they had moved. They'd moved locations like a mile away from where they were, less than a mile from where they used to be. And, I just never got around to their new location. I kind of forgot about them. I think I even went to their old location during the summer and they were, you know, obviously not there anymore and just never thought to, you know, go down the road another half mile to their new spot. But anyway, I was there and I was digging through the bins and I wound up with one lousy issue of Azrael to take home with me. But as I was checking out, there was a guy like going through his stack on the edge of the counter, and it was all this run of Catwoman, which was bizarre to me because it's not something you see very often, and it's certainly not something that I'd see anybody actively pursuing or talking about. And this is why I don't know how to say Ballant, because there were like three people there. There was a guy working there and these two other guys, and they each said Ballant a different way. It was like Belen, Balint, and Belent or something like that. It was very, very odd. So gotta assume one of them was right. But he was rifling through his pile and he had these cataclysm issues and he had the subsequent no man's land issues. And all I could think was like, man, if I didn't find those very same books a couple days ago, I would be like hardcore bumming out right now. In any event, I guess this fellow was a Belent completionist. That's what he said anyway. He was trying to collect all of Belent's covers, I believe, or Balint. However we say it, however we say the name. But I tell you, it was so weird and so coincidental. It just kind of reminds you how like small and niche and you know, family-like the comics collecting crowd can be, where I don't know, it's just very, very strange. I don't think I'd given these books a second thought, much a first thought even, much less a second thought. And here, in the course of a week, like, I found them, this other fella found them, and talking about them, it's just weird. Now, speaking of talking about them, how about we do that? I'll stop rambling and vamping. Boy, I can't say words today. Let's get it. I guess, how's that different from any other day? Let's get into it. This is Catwoman Volume 2, Number 56, which had an April 1998 cover date. And you know what? I'm going to Columbo you here. One more thing. Catwoman Volume 2, just like we had Nightwing Volume 2. This is a weird thing here. I get very, very up my own ass about, like, volume numbers. It's just one of my major defects as a whatever the hell it is that I am. But growing up, like when you look at the price guides, like Wizard or Overstreet or whoever the hell else was putting out price guides back then, sometimes like the Catwoman miniseries would be called Catwoman miniseries. Sometimes it would be called Catwoman Volume 1. And that was the same with Nightwing. You know, the Nightwing miniseries is sometimes called Nightwing miniseries. Sometimes it's called Nightwing Volume 1. Robin, forget about it. We'll talk about that either next episode or the episode after that, when I go really, you know, anal on these on these volume numbers, because that one's a trip too. I'm just wondering, what do you guys call it? Like, if you even bother to call it, because, I mean, at the end of the day, this is just stupid crap that keeps morons like me awake. But this Catwoman ongoing, would you call it just Catwoman? Would you call it Catwoman Volume 1? Would it be Catwoman Volume 2? Please let me know and let me feel a little less alone in the world. But, okay, I'll stop there. Let's talk about the damn story. Cataclysm, Part 6, Claustrophobia. Written by Devin Grayson with pencils by Jim Belent? Balent? Balent? I don't know. Inks, John Stanisi. Colors, Buzz Setzer. Letters, Albert de Guzman. Edits, Gorfinkel O'Neill. Cover price, $1.95. Now we open with Catwoman popping her head out of a vent above the floor of a crowded Boodingdale's department store. Here she soliloquizes. I'm telling you, words are, for someone who writes and talks a lot, I don't know words. She kind of waxes poetically about Gotham City and how it's the second worst city to live in if you're a criminal. And yet, those criminals still keep coming. Even with things like plagues and regular prison and asylum outbreaks, they keep coming. And so she surmises that there's just something special about this city. She's here to swipe something, naturally, and she worries that, should she get caught this time, well, the cops are going to skip Blackgate and they're going to send her directly to Arkham. The soliloquy continues for a bit as she swipes a pair of Wayne Tech compact Ruby Zoom night vision binoculars and wriggles her way back through the vents to a nearby elevator shaft in order to make her exit. Now you see, she needs those binocs for a heist she's looking to pull. Just as she's hopping down to the roof of an elevator car, well, the clock hits 7:03 and the very bad thing happens. Selina thinks that she's triggered some sort of security system, and in the ruckus, nearly drops the binoculars she needs for that job. The good news is, well, she didn't. She bobbled them a bit, but she caught them. The bad news is, the elevator cable snapped, and she's sent into a free fall. This, it turns out, is the the image used for the cover. It's her falling, you know, down an elevator shaft, which looks really, really awesome on the cover. Now, just like the folks on the subway car over in Detective 720, she assumes a building was bombed or nuked or whatever, never for a moment considering that it might have been an earthquake. She uses her whip and she manages to latch onto something to ease her fall, though she still does land pretty hard. After freeing herself from the ruins of the elevator shaft, she sees quite the gruesome scene. And, you know, we've talked about these, like, big panning shots that we've had in almost every chapter so far. And, I mean, the artists just went to town. Just, and it's, like, not gratuitous or gory. But, I mean, you can see the decimation. You can, like, feel it, you can smell it, you can hear it. It's really, really well done. And I mean, what she sees here, I just said it's not gratuitous or nor gory. And I mean, it could be gorier, but there is some gore. People are crushed. There's blood everywhere. It's very, very intense. I guess tastefully done. I don't know. Looking past all that, Selena spies a uniformed policeman attempting to free a young girl from some fallen rubble. Now, this girl is bleeding very, very heavily, and it's not looking good at all. The man proceeds to try wrapping her in his jacket to stop the blood. Then, he spots Catwoman and immediately draws his gun on her. Now, though wildly annoyed by this, Catwoman appears to find this pretty adorable. And, like, without even a second thought, just whips the pistol right out of the dude's hands. Now, the officer, he looks at her and he accuses her of being the one behind the supposed building bombing. And she's like, no, it wasn't me, you know? And she goes as far as to say that she's never killed anyone. She's no killer. You know, except for during that short run in Action Comics Weekly we talked about a few years ago, if you're familiar with that run. Anyway, Selena takes over tending to the girl while the officer attempts to locate any other survivors. The girl tells her that she looks just like a kitty cat, which I suppose is something a child might say. Catwoman suggests that due to the girl's shallow breathing that she may have punctured a lung. Unfortunately, there's really nothing at the moment that anyone can do. The officer asks Selena to simply keep talking to the child, you know. Just try to keep her calm, keep her from going into a full-blown panic. Let's just, you know, ease this child as best we can. And so they spend a page or so talking about kitty cats. The girl has two, and Selena's got, she's got a lot of cats. The girl starts talking about how she's feeling cold. Selena wonders if, you know, she's just feeling cold in her extremities, or if it's her entire body, and unfortunately it is her entire body. The little girl then asks if the tooth fairy is real, because, well, she has a loose tooth. Then she dies. Catwoman attempts mouth-to-mouth, but it's of no use. The officer, who narrowly avoids being crushed by a falling beam, tells her not to blame herself, and how, under the current circumstances, it's going to be impossible to save everybody. Selena starts to feel the walls closing in on her, very, very claustrophobic, which I guess is the title of the issue. You'll have to forgive me, I don't remember whether or not claustrophobia is like a known thing about Selena or not. I can't remember. I this isn't a book I followed, and Catwoman isn't really a character that I followed or even follow now. Anyway, the officer, seeing how tense she's getting, he puts his hand on her shoulder in order to comfort her. She pushes him away and leaps toward a hole in the ceiling to find a way out. She traverses through the wreckage in the floor above, using an incoming breeze to direct her to freedom, or so she thinks. It's here that she and we get an eyeful of the Ballant-flavored view of the decimated post-quake Gotham. I mean, just like the rest of the artists taking part in Cataclysm, he kills it. He nails it. Seeing a spread like that, and I mean, I was going to say, I'm going to apologize for repeating myself, but I think I repeatedly apologize for repeating myself, so that's kind of a thing, I guess. You see a spread like this, you'll know that there's no easy fix. There's no quick fix. There's no going back. This is a literal shattering of the status quo. And I've said it before, but damn, what a ballsy move, right? Now, with this new information, you know, that the building was in fact not bombed and that the city was just wrecked, Selena returns inside down to the officer. She gives him the whole, yeah, I got good news and I got bad news spiel. The good news being she found a way out. The bad news is it's kind of the end of the world out there. And I guess there's extra bad news since, that way out that she found requires using her whip to, like, Tarzan over to another building nearby. And so, over the course of the next several pages, Catwoman delivers the small group of survivors to the relative safety of the next building over. Which kind of reminds me of the Nightwing scene where he pulls those survivors out of the bus, one by one. I'm not sure if parallels are meant to be made, but I dig it all the same. You know, it shows us that these heroic actions aren't, like, hand-wavy. You know, it's not like, you know, and so 5 minutes later, they're all saved. This is, it's like personal. It's like intimate in a way. You know, one-on-one, taking these people to safety, ferrying them over, knowing that with each swing or each yank out of the bus, that there may not be any going back. And I like that it's... I don't know if meticulous is the right word for it, but I mean, you feel it. You feel it, and it really works out well. We close out the issue with Selena looking at the flaming wreckage that was once her home city, and after she takes in one more eyeful of it, she begins to sob. Next time out, Robin, volume whatever we're going to call it, number 52. Alrighty, so let's talk about it. This was a really good issue. I'm really enjoying seeing where each of our feature characters are as the Quake Kids. Like we've talked about before, it illustrates how out of nowhere this disaster was, and how most disasters are. Nobody was prepared, and it wasn't something that could have ever been stopped or avoided. You know, it's bigger than the bad guys, it's better than the bad guys. I really like the depiction here, and I like how I mean, I've talked about this before, and again, to repeat myself, it's like our heroes, our characters, I'll say, are just going about their business when everything changes. A lot of us have been alive for, you know, things that have happened that have changed everything. You know, one second, everything's going one way, and then the next second, nothing will ever be the same. And, like these opening chapters are almost like the superhero approximation of, or the comic book approximation of slice of life, where, okay, going about my regular day and then, well, not anymore, right? There's a new normal and it's going to take some adjusting to. Now, we've talked a fair amount on this channel about the writer of this issue. I mean, there's an episode of the Cosmic Treadmill. If you go on your audio device and scroll about 10 miles deep down the list of shows, you'll find an episode where Reggie and I discussed a certain inconvenient issue of Nightwing. Which I've also written about, and it's oddly one of my most viewed posts over at the blog. Like, pretty much every single week, it's on the top of my stats. It's a pretty infamous issue. And if you're familiar with it, you know. If you know, you know. If you don't, it doesn't take you long to find out. Now, the tone and tenor of that discussion, as well as my own coverage on the blog, might give you the impression that I'm not a fan of this writer. But that's not the case at all. Devin Grayson, in my opinion, is a really good writer. Though she does have some tendencies that remind me a bit of, well, me. Not that I'm comparing our levels of writery or storytelling talent. I mean, one of us is a professional and one of us is an idiot who talks to himself into a microphone. It's just that Devin tends to, in my opinion, overwrite. She can be very, very wordy. And not in a Claremontian sort of way, but in a... Hell, I hate to say this because it's going to sound like a dismissal or an insult, but I assure you that it's not. It reads a little bit, and again, this is not meant as an insult, but it reads a little bit fanficky, which maybe I'm manifesting this since, you know, I already know that Ms. Grayson did get her start in the appas in the fanfic community. Like I said, though, it's not bad. It's actually quite good. And I totally remember her style feeling kind of like a breath of fresh air when I first discovered it back around the turn of the century. And it wasn't because she was a girl writer. It was because she was good. Everything felt fresh and new. It felt like a new voice. Comics kind of, at least the comics that I read, because I mean comics is a very broad medium. But in the comics I read, everything felt kind of the same. It was the same voices. It was the same sort of ticks. But Grayson and, you know, her cohorts, you know, we're gonna be covering a lot of them during the run here on NML Crossing, like the Greg Ruckas and the like, you know, felt very, very fresh, felt very, very new. And I mean, the name Devin doesn't exactly tip you off that this is a woman writing these books, right? So I'm guessing the first few times I read her, I didn't even know. What was I saying about wordiness and not getting to a point? That's me. brevity and subtlety are not really on display in this here issue. There are soliloquies over explanations. pretty much, if you're familiar with me talking to you or writing at you, it's kind of like what I do. I have this weird allergy toward brevity, or is concision a word? Is that how you say concise in a different way? I don't know. How about I stop circling this particular drain and we just talk about the story? It's another 703 story, of course, which is totally fine. Selena is going to be a player in the No Man's Land story toward, I want to say, the latter third of the run. At least if the reading orders that I'm amalgamating into our to-do list are correct. So, it's cool to see where she was and what she was up to when the very bad thing happened. That said, while I enjoyed this, there was something kind of paint-by-numbers about it. And again, it's no fault of the issue itself. Like, you know, we've got this sort of kind of bad guy in Catwoman who, in the face of disaster, is thrust into this role of protector and savior. I feel like we've kind of seen this trope play out many times in comics. Which, again, doesn't make it bad, because this wasn't bad. It just makes it kind of difficult to actually, you know, talk about. Which, you know, is kind of what I try to do here, with extreme emphasis on the word try, because there are definitely more erudite folks you could be listening to right this very moment. Overall, like I've said probably a dozen times to this point, I liked this. Catwoman was not a book I would have ever thought to pick up back in 1998 or 1999 or any time, except for maybe like that first year of the Brubaker volume, really. But I tell you what, I'm glad this NML project kind of forced my hand and gave me an actual reason to check it out. We're going to have another issue of Catwoman that we'll be chatting up as part of the Cataclysm. Then I want to say we got 5 or so issues later on under a different writer, John Ostrander, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm certainly looking forward to more, and I hope you are as well. Before we cut out of here, let's hop into the mailbag. We have a few short missives to discuss. First one came to me via the blog from CJ Standall, and he says, "Good to hear you back recording. I love No Man's Land, but I also only read those 5 trade paperback volumes from the turn of the century. I'm just now, for some reason, finding out that these trades didn't collect the whole No Man's Land storyline. I knew it didn't collect Cataclysm and other precursors to the story, but I never knew that it was a scattershot collection of the NML stuff." And totally, that's exactly how I felt. And it took me a minute to realize that they weren't complete or even near complete. You know, I felt like when I found those, because I was collecting those as they came out, because they started coming out into the New Gotham era, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but I know I bought at least half of those five trades on release day, you know, when they hit, because I was following along that way, or I just decided to follow along that way, and I felt like I was getting away with murder. You know, it's like, oh, all these suckers had to buy hundreds of issues to follow this story, and here I am, you know, taking advantage of not being an early adopter, and I have the whole story in these very, very thin trades. Should have known right away how uninclusive these collections were. I haven't even flipped through. I have them sitting here next to me. I haven't flipped through them to see which stories did appear. I think that could be a fun thing to look at, just to see how much was missing and how many people were in the same boat as us back around the turn of the century, receiving the story in these wildly abridged trade collections. Now, I think I was probably tipped off that these things were so abridged when the next generation of the trades came out, like the new collections, the new printings or whatever. And, you know, I'm looking at No Man's Land Volume 1, and it's like twice as thick as the No Man's Land Volume 1 that came out in, you know, turn of the century. It's like, huh, oh, maybe they're combining volumes. And then you see, like, the full spread when they all come out, and it's like, huh, that's quite a bit thicker than the five volumes I have. But I would like to thank you so much for checking it out, CJ, and I hope you stick around and we get to experience, you know, the full scope of this No Man's Land era together for the first time. Next, a very brief welcome from our friend Andrew McAvoy over at the blog. He says, I'm glad to hear you back on the airwaves / podwaves. And I like to include things like this because, you know, I'm nobody. I mean, I tend to believe that nobody notices if I'm here or if I'm not here. So it's always very, very heartwarming to get a welcome back like that, especially from a pal like Andrew. So thank you very, very much for your kind words. Finally, our buddy Jason over on Twitter, he says, I love the first episode and issue. I'm a sucker for anything that really takes advantage of the comic form, so I thought having Momo's fantasy vision directly juxtaposed with the cold bat reality was a great and memorable gimmick. Seems like this Chuck Dixon guy really knows his way around a comic. And yeah, this was a really, really cool gimmick that I was afraid that I kind of butchered in the description, and I might have in my trying to describe what's happening here. But in case you haven't listened to the first episode or if you've forgotten, this is a scene where we got this guy who's on his way to Blackgate Prison, and he's recounting his tale of his run-in with the Batman. And this is a post-Zero Hour story, so Batman, for all intents and purposes, does not exist. Publicly, officially, he is an urban legend. He's something put out there to scare criminals. He is not real. So that gives creative license to criminals and bad guys who claim or have actually run into him. So we got this guy Momo, who's a real loser, and he's talking about his run-in and how the Batman that he fought and beat, of course, because Momo did get the better of the Batman, was 7 feet tall, between 300 and 400 pounds. He had the claws of a tiger. He was just a bestial character that Momo beat up. And that's what we're actually seeing play out on the left side of the page. We're seeing this monstrous Batman just getting his ass kicked. But on the right side of the page, we're seeing what actually happened, which was this dude Momo getting knocked out in one punch from Robin, which it's so cool to be able to play with the comics language that way. And it also makes great use of that odd and awkward Batman doesn't really exist era in the character's history. So really cool stuff. And I'm so glad you were able to check out the issue and listen to my butchering of it, Jason. So thank you so much for your kind words. And if anybody out there has any kind, unkind, or in the middle comments to make, please feel free to do so. You can find me all those different ways. What is it here? WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, ChrisIsOnInfiniteEarths.com, Ace Comics on Twitter, 90s X-Men on Facebook, all those places you can reach out and we can talk about this stuff or whatever you want to talk about. I'm always around. But with all that said, I am creeping up on a half hour of invading your ears, so I will close it off here. I'd like to thank you all so much for spending some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya.
Just makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks.